Hey, everybody, we're going to be doing what's going to be a legendary episode today. It's going to be known as the Espresso Martini episode.
We're cracking open the cold one with the boys.
Cracking open the cold one with the boys. We have a four-pack of First Press Merchants Cold Drip Coffee Espresso Martini.
Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, our love affair with coffee doesn't stop when the sun goes down.
Oh, that sounded so damn good in the headphones.
We're all going to open them. Do we want to try doing it once, or... What would you rather hear?
I think we can try it once.
Yeah, I want to hear it once.
I just want to, like, it's going to be an eargasm for me. So, yeah.
You count us in.
3, 2, 1. Oh.
Oh, there's espresso martini in your face.
Yeah, I know.
It's up here.
Yeah.
All right, let's...
I mean, it smells good. Let's have a sippy, everybody.
It smells delightful.
Oh, it's so sweet.
It smells like Kahlua.
Yeah, it is. Oh, that's how I like my coffee. So fucking sugary.
Yeah.
Mm.
Oh my God. Oh no.
So, a toxic habit is making my husband age like milk. This is from the Daily Mail.
Oh, this wasn't just about me?
No. To the sexual proclivities.
I can't find out. I'm really sorry. I can't find out.
You can't find it?
Yeah, I can't find it.
God damn it.
The archive doesn't
have
it as well.
We're never gonna know. And then what are we supposed to do?
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do about my husband?
Yeah,
I don't know his toxic trait.
He's getting so old. He gets older by the minute. God, he's fucking ancient.
What am I supposed to do if I don't know my husband's toxic trait?
Yeah, what are you going
to...
You
have to ask
Yana
and subscribe to the Daily Mail.
What if I just ask Yanni and we could find out now?
What's
my toxic trait that makes me grow old?
It's just...
Is it like the refreshing of my cells every 7 years or whatever?
Yeah, I was going to say your...
The metabolic rate in which I decline?
It's the Catholic guilt.
That'll do it.
All right, well... Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Shouldn't Have Come, a podcast about two canoes tied together in a harsh and unforgiving... Wait a second. That's how I introduced our last episode in our series about Papua New Guinea. Do you remember when I said that?
I do. It was great.
Yeah, it was weird, right? It's how an Australian police officer, known locally as a kiap, described the process of independence to people in Papua New Guinea. He's like, well, right now, you see, our two countries are like two canoes tied to each other in an ocean. But at independence, we're going to cut the rope and your canoe will be free to do what it wants. He's like, this is how I'm going to explain.
It's like, hey, if you imagine like two canoes, right? Hey.
And they're like, I just want to understand.
But they're tied together.
Do we still need to pay taxes to you?
No, you're not listening. It's two canoes and they're tied together. All right? Do you understand? With like rope or string or something.
What? Who? The police officer, is he staying or is he going?
I really don't think you're understanding. It's two canoes out in the ocean, right? The big water. And they're tied by a rope.
And who put the rope there?
Look, that's...
Why are we tied together? Neither of us can steer properly.
Were we free before?
I really don't think you're understanding the metaphor very much, and that's okay, I get it. But what I've got written here to tell you is that our two countries are like canoes. Can you understand the canoes?
Okay, Dr. Zeus.
It's actually Dr. Sois, you know?
And that's Kiap Sois to you.
That's Kiap Sois. Kiap Sois. Anyway, we're going to finish the analogy. Welcome back to Shouldn't Have Come, a podcast about a 1,000-foot nuclear-powered aircraft carrier sailing behind a single canoe bombing in the ocean.
Jesus Christ.
Hell yeah.
Which I think is more... correct of how the Australia-Papua New Guinea relationship works.
I believe so.
When we recorded and released episode 1, the signing of the Australia-PNG military alliance had stalled, but in the intervening weeks, everything has fallen into place for Albo and James Marape, the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea.
Mm.
So they've approved the Puk Puk Defence Treaty with Australia. Puk Puk is the Atolai word for crocodile, if you remember the Tolai people of episode 1.
Yes.
And it ratifies the tremendous military influence that Australia already exerts over the region. There are plans for 10,000 Papuan soldiers to serve in the ADF. and they're going to be granted pathways for citizenship. Potential pathways. I think it's going to be like, you have to get 50 kills or whatever.
Jesus Christ.
You got to kill 50 of them, Han. Yeah,
you got to do a PB out there, boys.
You got to get a PB.
You got to get like a Slayer or something, and you just have that voice that happens like, yes, I'm Australian.
Yeah. Australian. they're probably going to do a bunch of grunt work that's below the Australian soldier. Like the actual prosecution of this imaginary armed conflict we're preparing for. You know, that one, the war we've been in for 20 years. I'm so tired. When will my toxic husband return from the war? This whole process is being weaponized by Anthony Albanese's floundering political enemies. Political enemies.
Hell yeah.
Anyway, his floundering enemies are weaponizing this whole process because of the clumsiness with which it was carried out, rather than just the crazy colonial military naval empire ramifications. I do really rate this line from some dickhead at the Lowy Institute.
When it comes to the Pacific, there are always going to be Australian foreign policy missteps.
If he stopped the article there, it'd be a much better article. But he goes on to be like, but these are actually really good treaties, even though it was kind of clumsy. But, like, yeah, that's the Pacific.
When we talk about our island neighbours, we are going to fuck it up.
Yeah.
Every time.
And that's the whole process. Like clockwork.
So, yeah. Fuck you, Blake.
Yeah, fuck off, Blake.
Fuck Blake. What are our thoughts
fuck
on Blake?
You, Blakey.
Kill yourself.
All right, Elle.
Jump into an anemone.
Anyway, basically, the scope of military actions that Australia can take under international law has widened for whatever international law is worth. For more on this, see the Great Satan, Israel. Obviously, the mostly imagined threat of the Grand Dragon of the East, China, is at the forefront of people's think pieces, but Papua New Guinea also has a breakaway state seeking independence, the aforementioned Bougainville. The Papuan military used helicopters from Australia to massacre Bougainvillians back in the 90s, so, you know, the cyclical nature of fashion strikes again.
Yeah, this also feels like the story of the Tolai and the Binding.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's quite similar to that, really, just, I guess, happening on a much larger scale.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's something like 20,000 people were killed.
Fuck.
And Australia gave Papua New Guinea these military helicopters, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they took the guns off them and were like, you can't put guns back on these. And Papua New Guinea's like, absolutely, we won't. And then they just put other guns on them.
Yeah.
And so they had these, and Australia was like, you can't.
Don't put
guns on the gunships. And it's like, what did you?
I mean, it just feels like they were doing like, feels like they were kind of winking, like, don't put guns on there.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't do it. No, stop. This is where they'd go if you did put them on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We've put arrows there.
They just disassembled it, sent it to them in parts, and then they reassembled it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, where'd they get the guns from?
Yeah.
So, to get this incredibly advantageous military deal for Australia, all it cost was the $500 million military base upgrade we talked about last time, some flashy new upgrades to the Papuan Parliament House that we talked about last time, which cost something like $200 million, and the $600 million spent to set up the Guinea Gooners in the NRL.
God damn it.
The team hasn't been named yet. There's a competition going on for it, I think.
Gosh, I hope the Gooners win.
I hope the Gooners win. We'll enter it. Isn't it weird that the NRL keeps being brought up into this, like, military deal?
No, by this point in the podcast,
yeah,
it always comes up.
It does always come up. Rugby is the entire backbone of this society.
It's been 19 years, but the Broncos are back on top of the rugby league world.
It doesn't seem related if you're not someone who's on this podcast until you know the Australian funding is contingent on Papua New Guinea's commitment to Australia as a security partner, which Australia gets to judge. So they can basically say, we will take the rugby team away from you if you sign any kind of deal with China about security matters, which we can judge. We'll take your rugby team. We'll take the Gooners away.
This sounds like a toxic older sibling.
It does.
Like, I've set all the rules, and if you don't follow my rules, which means you'll lose, exactly. You'll lose anyway.
Exactly. Mm. So the ABC article I'm quoting from said both Albo and Marape played down the rugby and war links. They're like, no, you know, that's a standard thing in our deals. It's not, we're not linking rugby to defense, blah, blah, blah.
We're always offering rugby teams.
The ghoulish NRL boss Peter Vlandis made clear how Australia sees Papua New Guinea's relationship with rugby and this military deal.
Rugby league is the number one sport in the Pacific. This new club will solidify rugby league's role as the unifying language of our region. The security agreement goes hand in hand with the NRL Pact and will make the relationship between our two countries unbreakable. I'm very confident that PNG won't strike a deal with China because rugby league is such a religion in PNG that they'd never take the risk of doing a deal with another country.
Yeah, right.
That was good.
That was fantastic. I like how you did kind of an elbow.
It was light elbow.
Light elbow for Peter Vlandis. What a demeaning way to speak about a people. There's just all these extra villains in Australian society that force themselves into our world. Like, who the fuck is Peter Vlandis, you know? And his weird fucking apostrophe. It's one of the most ghastly people that I hadn't even heard about till a few months ago. He's like head of the NRL.
I feel like I've read something about him at some point with like gambling and sports gambling and shit. And I was like, this is shonky.
He's in trouble for kind of being kind of like this, a bit too open about what Australia hopes for in the relationships, what the NRL hopes for in the relationships with gambling companies, where everyone else is like, oh, you know, we want to regulate. And he's like, oh, I hope we get $1 million in bets on the first day.
It's like, fuck, man, Peter, mask back on, bro.
Yeah, he also looks so slimy with his hair. Just like, he barely has any, but it's all slicked back to the nines.
Yeah, I understand Vlandis and this weird apostrophe spelling of it is like a weird fuck-up misspelling of a Greek name.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, and it's not usually spelt with an apostrophe because that's absurd.
See, for a second there, I thought it was Peter V. Landis, and I was like, Landis.
Landis.
A few articles I looked at compared the $1.1 billion for a football team and Manus Island upgrades to the $637 million aid budget that Australia has with Papua New Guinea in general. The obvious question being, wasn't there something better to spend the money on than the Guinea Gooners in a conference room, given the things we are trying to provide aid for, even though I don't think that's really being provided in good faith based on how the financialization of aid works, clearly aren't happening. So, being Indian and Australian, I'm very familiar with the idea of athletic worship. Sport isn't the modern religion, though idols inhabit many forms. The athlete, the nymph, the druid, the fairy, the soldier, the
barbarian.
Warlock, the barbarian, the oracle, the beasts of the greatest expanse, the terrors of the deepest oceans, the ghosts embedded in trenches inside the coldest mountains, goblins, ghouls, a zombie with no conscience.
Fucking goddamn it!
His name is Gary and I love him.
His name is Gary. And all of these idols carry with them a fandom. The expression of dozens of hundreds of people's coping mechanisms, and an idol can turn this fandom into votes, money, and power. People often ask, how could the people of whichever exploited country this is let this happen when weak shit like this happens, when like a country's sold out underneath them? Like they've been hoodwinked, this prime minister of whatever, into supporting policies that are ultimately harmful to their people. Rather than people being granted power by a system and behaving in the ways that help maintain that power, and the existence of power itself being how these national-level exploitations can happen in the first place. Yep, today we're going to spend some time talking about the people being paid off to take advantage of people that look like them in the service of people who don't live anywhere near them. Once upon a time, I used to refer to this person as a race trader.
Dun-dun!
Get him!
Do you remember the race trader era?
I do remember the race trader era. Yeah. It was a popular era.
It was a pretty
popular
era.
People are calling for its return.
I don't know if they're calling for it to return. I think people liked it at the time, but like cultures moved past the race trader era. For those of you who aren't Karen, the race trader era was a few years ago when my New Year's resolution was I'm going to call more people race traders.
That makes more sense. I was going to say race tradering has happened for a very long time. I was like, what specific era are we talking about?
Yeah, which one?
You know, Yanni's public calling out of race traderism. Race treachery.
Yeah, I decided to make that my like main thing for a year. It was pretty good. Next year, I was
following year, she was like, I think I'll wear more hats this year.
Yeah, and I did. That didn't go anywhere.
I love the spectrum of more hats versus calling randoms a race trader.
It's just what I'm feeling.
And then I think
it
followed up with like,
I wanted to be less
clumsy. Idolatry. Oh.
No, less idolatry was the year after.
And then
yes,
I think there's
yes.
clumsy.
Then there was clumsy. Anyway, so people will, knew me at the time, will report that I was very successful in this endeavor to the point that I understood that race isn't real. I understood that unreality of the concept of race. The idea of a race trader is pretty simple. Somebody who acts against the interests of their race to benefit themselves and usually the white man.
Yay, here I am. A proud symbol.
Whether that be Indian dudes in the Liberal Party, Asian dudes in the army, black cops, whoever. I was throwing this term around pretty liberally. And if the world was broken down into distinct biological races connected to discrete hive minds, that would be a useful analytical term, but it isn't, so it's not. Once again, thank you, mixed race people, for being biologically viable.
You're so welcome.
And whatnot.
You're so welcome.
Flex on him.
Yeah, flex on him. I'm happy to be of service, I guess.
But in my reminiscing about this time in my life, I did come across the See Also section for the race trader entry on Wikipedia, which had a collection of culturally distinct versions of race traders. You know, because we've all heard about, like, coconuts, Oreos, and bananas.
Which I hadn't, actually.
Yes, you knew about Oreos.
Yes, I knew about Oreos.
Tell the people what Oreos are.
It's a black person who acts white.
And why is it called an Oreo?
Because is that what an Oreo looks like? It's got the black...
Wait, do you know what an Oreo is?
It's a cookie.
Yes, okay, cool, yeah.
It's like a biscuit that I don't like.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a cream-filled brown chocolate biscuit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and same idea with coconut and banana, yellow on the outside, white on the inside, or brown on the outside, white on the inside. So, but we all know of that flavor of term where it's like the skin color on the outside, but then on the inside is white.
Mm. Quite Americanized, I think, in many ways.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah, we are.
Because they're obsessed with food.
They're obsessed with food. I mean, what else are they going to do?
Oh my God.
So I thought we'd try to guess who is tradering against who. For each of these terms that I've got ready for you. So if you want to go to the next slide, you've got race traders worldwide.
Let's
the
go.
First term we have is boba liberal.
Okay, boba liberal is going to be something to do with, is like boba from like Japan or Korea or China?
Koreans really love it, but also Vietnamese stores sell it.
Fuck, okay, boba liberal is going to be a young Asian person who is conservative.
Mm. Kind of. A young Asian person who is, like, surface-level liberal. So...
surface-level woke?
Sorry. Yes. Liberal in the American sense.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So a boba liberal is someone who's, like, Asian person who lives in the West but is really into, like, representation politics and things like that. You know, surface-level liberal things rather than, like, hey, what about the substantive things that, in theory, by being from somewhere else you should know about, but you're a boba liberal, is the idea. All right, the next one we have... And I know that L actually knows this term, but
yeah,
mankurt. Kieran, what do you reckon mankurt's? Oh, I shouldn't have said that L knows this term specifically. But yeah, Kieran, what do you reckon mankurt's about?
Okay, God. Clearly, Euro in all origin. Mankurt. All I got is this man skirt. Okay, mankurt is a...
You can't pause...
Hey, he's thinking.
I'm thinking.
He's using the brain that
I'm
inside
trying.
The
mind. I'm
no,
trying.
I'm sorry, that's so
rude. Please, I'm
pause
trying.
As long as you want to
edit
it, it's fine. It's
okay,
so
great.
Easy to edit.
Great. Okay. A mankurt is how I feel when Yanni interrupts me. I feel pretty man hurt.
Oh,
because I'm mean interrupts. You would pause for like 3 seconds.
I'm feeling even more. I'm feeling man harmed right now. I'm pretty man wounded.
You feel man killed?
I feel man killed. Actually,
what's the
okay? Mankurt is gonna be a German who pretends he's not.
All right. El, do you want to describe what your understanding of mankurt was?
So, mankurt is the term.
Yeah, like I said, mankurt.
So, a mankurt is basically a non-ethnic Russian. It was a term used in the USSR a lot. It's basically a non-ethnic Russian that has allowed themselves to be Russified, in a sense, that has essentially cast off their ethnic ties and assimilated into... society as, you know, a mostly Russified person. The term is like, it comes from a book by a Kyrgyz author. And it basically referred to like prisoners of war. It's like a semi-fantasy, semi-sci-fi kind of thing. Like prisoners of war who then became kind of like these zombified beings of a hive mind that had basically no agency. So that's what a mankurt is in that context. And it comes from some sort of Turkic or Mongolic word.
So as opposed to like the American version, which is just like, you're this food, this has like a rich literary history. I think that's a pretty good like difference between the two despotic empire style things. All right, the next one we have is Cockservative.
Elle, do you want to have a crack at this one?
I guess this is a very Americanized term. It's conservatives that just like really love their guy, you know, be that like Donald Trump or like, you know, Charlie Kirk, rest in peace and shit like that.
Yeah, okay. Karen, is that your understanding of conservative?
Yeah, I would say, like...
Or do you not know about conservative, which is very defensible if you don't.
A fucking idiot. conservative, I would say, is, yeah, a conservative male who, like, kind of, like, froths at these, like, alpha-styled, like, gentlemen on that side of politics.
Yeah, okay.
Who just kind of, like, is like, fuck my wife, fuck my wife.
Interesting.
Fuck me.
So fuck me and fuck my wife.
That's cockservative when said by a progressive. So apparently cockservative is used within conservatives.
Oh.
By conservatives who view other conservatives as not, like, either, I guess, racist enough, you know, pussified conservatism. That's
yeah,
what
you're not on that real shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So the next term we have is Engelsman.
That's got to be, like, well, now I'm torn between two things. Part of me is like, yeah, that's somebody who goes to England and then is just like, oh, I'm English now, and forgets about, like, in the same way as, like, Mankurt. Or it is Joseph Engels, like, kin.
Joseph Engels. Yeah, it's the second one. You were correct.
What?
Yeah, it's people. No, it's not.
I was like, don't say that to me.
It's an Afrikaans word.
That makes
and
sense.
And it's used by, like, the Dutch Afrikaners who are like, oh, you're too into, like, English South Africans. All right, we got a couple left, only a couple. The next one we have is Kupapa. Where do you reckon that's from? Kupapa. I love it when you call me Kupapa.
Jesus Christ. I'm going to say that feels like it's from, like, the Pacific.
Oh, nice. It is a Maori word.
Okay.
It was used to describe Maori people, like, I guess, ethnically Maori people, indigenous Maori people who fought on the side of the British during the colonization. Because there was, like, a fair bit of that, because there's, like, different sets of people down there.
Yeah.
Apparently, and this might be apocryphal, but its literal meaning is dog crawling along the ground.
Damn.
That's a roast.
Yeah.
That's brutal.
It's brutal. Tochak Wagyu.
Damn.
That's how I'm saying it. What do you reckon Tochak Wagyu is?
God, that's... Okay, those two words look like they don't belong to the same language in my head. So I'm just going to, like, work that out.
Tochak Wagyu steak.
Okay, give me...
Is it Polynesian?
No, it's not.
Filipino?
No.
Is it, like...
Is it Indonesian?
No.
From the Americas?
No.
Mongolian?
No.
French?
No. It is a South Korean term, I understand, to describe pro-Japanese conservative Koreans. Yeah, we're getting really, like, specific here.
Dicey.
And the last one we have here...
I mean, it's understandable, to be fair.
Well, yes. I mean, and that, it makes sense there would be a term for it.
Yep.
And I'm sure it had a good etymology, but that's not what this episode's about. We've just been talking about it for 15 minutes.
We're just roasting.
The last race traitor we have is the... Malinchist. But it's a term used in Mexico for people who try to act like Europeans or Americans and like,
okay,
work for the Europeans or Americans in their interactions with other Mexicans.
Mm.
So the idea of the race traitor is cartoonish. Like, I am kind of thinking of high school. I'm thinking of a friend in high school who was, like, really determined to have a white boyfriend.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And it's like...
We know.
It's high school. Like, as terrifying as it is to think about, we all did something... Many really objectionable things in high school.
Mm.
But also, like, rich old Indian men who were like, you know, under the British, some things were better. Some things were better under the British. Actually, when you think about it, one thing about the British you have to really respect, their record-keeping systems are incredible. You know, like, that type of person.
Being like, hey, yeah, look, I know that this was, like, terrible for a lot of people, but, I mean, I was okay.
Yeah, as a member of the upper class...
Fine.
I
was chilling, actually.
It was actually going pretty well for me.
Exactly. I was a comprador. So the last term we looked at, Malinchism, takes us to our next character.
Ooh.
The intermediary. So this is La Malinche.
La Malinche or Malintzin.
On the screen, we've got a couple of pictures. Do you all want to describe what's going on here?
I mean, for starters, she's got a fire headdress. I actually do really like that. The single feather is... So it's kind of like a mix of a crown and like half of like a pope hat. And there's like a feather coming out of the side, which is quite fun.
Yeah. It's a fire fit.
Yeah, it's a black and white, like almost like a, is it a sketch?
I think it's a sketch. It's certainly not a photo. There's a lady from the 1500s.
That so, makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's like a sketch.
It's a good damn sketch.
Yeah. This is also like a little woodcut. That's Malinche there. And that figure there being depicted is Hernan Cortez.
Oh, shit.
And that figure there is Emperor Moctezuma.
Shit.
So the lady we have up on screen is Malintzin or Doña Marina, but most popularly La Malinche, or said perhaps more Spanishly.
La Malinche?
Or something like that.
I don't know if the accent is going to be on that's, the final vowel.
Elle wants to certify that that's absolutely correct, 100%.
Oh, shut
and
up.
Fully authentic.
Stop
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
That's Elle saying more
Stop
things
it.
About that. Anyway, so Doña Marina, Malinche, she was Hernan Cortez's interpreter during the Spanish conquest of the Aztec Empire. Now, it's unfair to refer to her as a traitor based on what I've read about the attested history, but she's often emotionally referred to as a traitor, or people are referred to as Malinches when they're acting in like race traitory kind of ways. And she is the kind of figure that exists in these stories to lubricate the gritty processes of colonization. Very little is actually known about her life because we are talking about a lady from Mexico in the 1500s, written about retrospectively by the conquistadores that destroyed the Americas. But it seems like she was a lady that was able to speak languages from different parts of Mexico. So Nahuatl, both the common and noble forms, and a couple of different Mayan languages. And this seems to be because she was sold as a slave from a Nahuatl-speaking community to a Mayan-speaking community before the Spanish arrived. And then when Cortez's fucking goons destroy this Mayan-speaking community where she's a slave, as part of the, like, we've destroyed your city, now we get shit, she gets sold to Cortez. Right, and she's like all the women are distributed amongst Cortez's men, and then they're like, "Oh, you can speak all the languages that we need to speak." Right? She can't speak Spanish, obviously, but she speaks Mayan, she speaks Nahuatl, and they have this guy named Geronimo, and Geronimo speaks Mayan, and so they're able, and he also speaks Spanish. He's like a castaway.
Damn. So okay, so you get instructions from like Cortez to Hernando. Did you say?
No, Geronimo.
All right.
How'd you get that?
I know, because like, as soon as you said it, I was like, say Geronimo, Geronimo.
Oh, God.
Okay, so Geronimo, okay, so this is just like a train of translations.
Yes.
This is like a really fun game of telephone.
I don't know about really fun, Karen.
It's not really fun.
I think it's really fun no. with disastrous consequences.
I don't think it's really fun. No, also, okay. is this Aguilar? Aguilar? Is that Aguilar? Or is Aguilar was that someone else?
Exactly. No, this is Aguilar. Geronimo Aguilar. I just thought that Geronimo was a funnier part of his name, but yeah, Geronimo
okay.
Aguilar.
Because he kept being referred to. Yanni sent me an article about Malinche.
Yes.
About Malintzin, and they kept referring to him as Aguilar, which is his surname.
Sorry, yes. I have a house style. We refer to people by first names.
Right.
You know, except for Albo, although I will call him Anthony a lot of the time. Mm. But in general, we refer to people by their first names, and so I'm calling him Geronimo. It's house style because, I mean, I want to call him Geronimo. It's kind of fun. And yeah, they're basically Cortez says to Geronimo, says to Malintzin, says to, you know, Moctezuma, the Aztec emperor, right? So aside from the literal translation of the words, Malintzin is reputed to have been instrumental in explaining the intentions and capacity of the Spanish army that she understood Cortez was bringing. Like, she's saying to people, like, hey, I've seen their guns, I've seen their cannons, I know the, like, the death they can make. And she's being taken more seriously because she's, you know, speaking Mayan or speaking Nahuatl. On a basic level, though, it did mean that Cortez, who is just some guy, a massive piece of shit, and, like, he's just some guy. He's not anyone important in Spain. But it meant he could negotiate and plan with like Nahuatl speaking or Maya speaking locals, turn them against each other and shit like that. I wish we were a podcast about the fall of Tenochtitlan because that is like an incredible story, and I heavily suggest you read about it a little. But essentially, the Spanish ally with some groups and destroy others, and people debate to this day whether Malinche is a traitor or the mother of the nation or whatever. Because eventually, she has a Cortez, you know, has a kid with her, as it were. I think she's referred to, I mean, in the source we looked at.
God, ugh.
The paper we read referred to a lot of previous work where she was referred to as Cortez's mistress.
They love that word. It's like their favorite word to use.
Yeah. But
because it's fun and sexy and not like, you know, just probably her being raped.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, she's a sex slave.
Yeah.
And she's sold to him as a sex slave, and then they realize she's a translator. And so she becomes like Cortez's personal slave, who's also kind of his assistant because she's also like, due to the fact that she is the one who has the final say over what's said back and forth, she has a great deal of power that normally isn't afforded to somebody who has been sold as a sex slave.
Fair.
So,
but she's still used as a sex slave on top of that.
Exactly. And so she has, one of the first mestizo kids. So one of the first kids in history whose parents are from different continents. Kind of weird.
That's nuts.
I mean, from different mega continents, I guess. The Americas versus the Eurasian continent. Kind of weird. And so that's why she's often referred to as the father of the nation, because it's like, oh, the first mestizo in Mexico were the mestizo, blah, blah, blah. I don't know.
Nice.
I meant mother of the nation. But my reason for bringing her up is that her lack of specific loyalty to the people who had, after all, made her a slave makes perfect sense. When you're doing a person-focused history, it's like, well, why would she be so ready to defend the, you know, people that made her a slave? When somebody came with, an option that presented her a way to improve her position from, like, random sex slave to privileged sex slave, and she took it. It's hard to call that traitoring.
Yeah, especially because I can't imagine you could comprehend, like, the absolute, like, bigness of the situation.
Yes.
Like, the scale of what was to come. Like,
exactly.
You can't, you know, hindsight's 20/20, but, like, when you're in it, she's just like, well, these are my best options.
Exactly. And she, you know, she probably made the best decisions for herself. Often in these colonial stories, you have these intermediaries who are really just like trying to end up on the winning side of a sudden massive power imbalance, choosing between a heavily armored and violent invading force and a detested, violent local people that don't work for them, that are, you know, a rival in some sense. And it's an impossible choice. And I suppose if you play it out in your head and you see how big or violent the... Because she sees the massacre... that leads to her, like, purchase or whatever. She's aware of it. And it's a, like, famous old story of, like, the first time a people are dealing with, a lot of guns. And so, obviously, there's a lot of confusion in how to deal with it. It's often retold as, like, they thought the Spanish were gods! And it's not true.
No.
But it's just like a literal, like, oh, my God, what is happening? Like, there's just bangs and there's blood.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the idea is that, you know, she tells the other people, like, hey, this is what's coming. Like, I saw this happen. So we kind of saw this in episode one, where we talked about the role that the Tolai played in helping Western interests colonize New Britain. But the role of the intermediary changes when the colonizing force seizes their active on-the-ground control, as many of the Western empires did after the Second World War, and as Australia did to Papua New Guinea just over 50 years ago. When this happens through the granting of independence rather than a violent revolution, the colonial power will usually install these intermediaries, their translators, their people on the ground, in positions of power. And those people help whichever Western power, in this context Australia, continue to extract the profits from the colony without having to spend as much money on, you know, training and sending soldiers out there and shit like that. This kind of relationship is basically what's described by the term neocolonialism. And the new role of the intermediary is described by these nerdy fucking Marxists, no disrespect, L, as, oh no, go back, the comprador. I didn't make a slide.
Nice.
Comprador comes from the Portuguese word for buyer, and basically it refers to people in colonized places who work at the behest of their colonizer. You know, like me.
Fuck.
Whoa.
I mean, I was a public servant here for a while. I'm from a colonized people. Primarily, however, it refers to those people who buy and sell land, facilitate foreign investment, give their overseas buddies good deals in exchange for kickbacks. The process of exogenously drawing up borders that don't match organic communities will result in conditions in which compradors thrive. If you can find somebody within the borders who's happy to let you mine the stuff under what they don't perceive as their land, but is now land they have control over because of the borders that have been drawn up, that's way easier to deal with. Just establish that person as a position in a position of power. You don't have to send a bunch of people out. They're going to be a good comprador, or you know, a sellout, which is a perfectly good way of describing it.
Oh my god, is that what Clive did?
Clive is a comprador for.
He didn't mine it. He got another company to mine it, and then he paid them. Made them pay the tax.
Yeah, Clive's kind of a. No, that's just a different thing.
Okay, that's fine.
Clive's kind of a comprador.
He's on the fence of a comprador.
If you perceive mining companies as a nation, Clive's a comprador.
But if they're doing it on the behest of a different nation trying to get a good iron source, then you could say so. Comprador Clive is a real thing.
But he's kind of like trying to be a double agent against both of the countries and failing at it. Like, eventually not able to betray either because... neither of them trust him.
Triple Agent Clive.
Triple Agent.
He's working like against himself.
He's like a negative one agent, you know? Like he's,
yeah, yeah.
Mm.
So a comprador is completely dependent on the colonizer for their continued wealth, but also their continued life. These motherfuckers tend not to be treated well once their misdeeds come to light and the security leaves and they stop being able to pay all of the people who keep them safe. Mm. So they need to keep the money flowing how it is as long as they can. The Papuan compradors, which much of the government's often accused of being, especially on Papuan Facebook, which I had a fun time reading about, tend to be quite subservient to things like Australian mining and military interests. They're kept happy with plush positions, frequent kickbacks, and rampant corruption. So, let's get into our story. Here's Julius Chan. That's Julius Chan. He was Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea for a while. Doesn't he look kind of like Kobe Bryant?
I was going to say, he's got incredible cheekbones.
Yeah.
I've got a picture of Kobe Bryant there.
You know, I do see that. The nose is different, absolutely, but I see the rest. Like,
yeah.
The shape of the ears as well, like...
Yeah, isn't that weird? Yeah. Anyway, I guess Julius Chan is the Kobe Bryant of wasting Papuan government money.
Fuck.
And he's also dead, so, you know, get fucked. Welcome to the section. I don't have a slide, but the section's called A Collection of Times Australians Conned Papua New Guinea Out of Money and Resources.
Yay!
Yay!
So first, Julius Chan, right? It's his government who killed all those people in Bougainville with the Australian helicopters during the Bougainville Civil War, which is the whole thing that led to the end of his regime. He's mad because the war has led to the closure of the Panguna copper mine on Bougainville, which was apparently the largest open-cut mine in the world at the time.
Hell really?
Damn.
Yeah, yeah.
What an island.
Yeah, it was most of... No, it wasn't most of it, but it was a big chunk of Bougainville. The owners of the mine, the British-Australian company Rio Tinto...
Of course.
yes, Rio Tinto.
...asked the deputy owner of the mine, the government of Papua New Guinea, to get shit started again and stop this whole Bougainville independence movement nonsense. So it's like Papua New Guinea owns like 20%, Rio Tinto owns like 60%, something like that. The Papuan government has no power on the island, right? Like, the Bougainville independence movement is pretty powerful. So they're looking for help from overseas. But since the usual powers no longer want to get involved, Australia's like, you've already embarrassed us. You told us you weren't going to use the gunships to shoot. They get in touch with Tim Spicer, OBE.
Tim Spicer.
This is Tim Spicer. He's British.
He looks British.
He looks like a sad author.
He does. He writes a lot of books now, actually. He wrote a book called The Sandline Affair. He's one of those dudes that just has goons you can call to handle shit. Like, he just knows goons.
Jesus.
That's my dream.
He's like a mercenary guy.
Author by day.
Author by day has goons.
Has goons. Yeah. You've heard about Hasbro, but what about Hasgoon?
Fuck. Stop, please. I can't.
I promise you it's not too late to kill yourself.
It's never too late. Well, actually, eventually.
Actually, yes. Yeah. One day we'll be.
I'm going to make it too late for you to kill yourself. So he got his OBE for facilitating the murder of Catholic teenagers in Northern Ireland. You know, he's a private security contractor, if you will.
Good shit.
He runs a company called Sandline. It's like a mercenary company.
Oh, is it because they're drawing a line in the sand or whatever?
I think so.
Fucking pathetic.
So
pussies.
So Julius organizes a $36 million contract with Tim, which I've written as Jim here, and it doesn't matter, but it is Tim Spicer. To provide like 44 white dudes to handle the situation for him, right? So hilariously, Tim outsources it to a South African like mercenary provider
well.
So he subcontracts it to them. He sends over 5 Australians,
the fuck?
And 8 British people, and then 31 South Africans.
What the fuck?
As mercenaries. He's going to end up signing a $300 million contract with the U.S. Army to manage 20,000 mercenaries in Iraq, which was the second biggest force in Iraq after the U.S. Army.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So this, like, this isn't going to really mention, like, merit a mention in his career retrospective. This whole affair, this pivotal role he plays in this island, right? Basically doesn't matter because right after this, this is like late 90s, right after this he goes to Iraq.
Yeah, and he's in charge 20,000. Of, like, a lot of those mercenaries that did all that absolutely heinous shit, like...
Yes. Abu Ghraib and shit. So anyway, back to Papua New Guinea. The army arrests and disarms these 44 or so dudes pretty quickly.
Fair enough.
The moment they land, they get off the airport in Papua New Guinea, and the army's like, hey, we haven't been paid in months. You took money from the education department to do this, Julius. You went behind everyone's backs. And also, we would have happily done this for you if you'd paid us $36 million. We would have happily gone and killed those Bougainvillians for you. So they just arrest these 44 dudes. Tim gets arrested as well. Then he gets released. And then he sues the Papuan government for the rest of the money that he's owed. Because they paid an $18 million deposit. And they were like, the other $18 million once you get the mine open on Bougainville again.
And damn, that's a Clive move.
Yeah, and then he sues them. And the Australian court says that they have to pay.
Jesus Christ.
So they're like, you know, even though it's like really corrupt for the government of Papua New Guinea to do this, they didn't sign the contract. You're going to have to pay Tim.
You shook on it. You made a deal.
So this obviously, yeah, this ended up killing the Julius Chan era, but it's crazy he even got this far. In 1994, he was working with Australian businessman, Labour Party associate, and sad sack looking Warren Anderson.
Oh no. Oh, he looks like a fucked up Tilda Swinton.
Oh, he does. Wait, one of you said he looked like a Muppet.
I said a Muppet.
He yeah,
like
a fucked up.
Even his mouth has like lines, like somebody's controlling him.
Yeah, so someone
him.
Could go like, rah, rah, rah,
oh
rah,
no,
rah, rah, rah.
Yeah,
oh, no.
And this is a photo from like one of his articles where he's like, I'm bankrupt because everyone's against me.
Nobody likes me, and I'm Warren.
Yeah, so it's not so much Julius working with Warren, but Julius's company, which is trading as Papua New Guinea, the country.
Jesus,
that's
Christ.
Working with Warren. Papua New Guinea makes this weird purchase that seems like a bad deal. They buy an office building in Cairns called the Cairns Conservatory. You know, it's in Cairns, Australia. They pay Warren $18.7 million for it, plus $1 million in extra payments. Doesn't that already sound pretty weird?
Yeah.
It's like a pension fund. They're like, we're investing in this building. We're also going to try to get, I think they were trying to get Air New Guinea to move into it. They were like, oh, you want us to move into this building that's all the way out of the city for more rent than we're currently paying? We're not doing that.
You know what that sounds like?
What does it sound like?
Monopoly when you're trying to screw somebody else over out of getting their full land.
It's funny you say that. It's very Monopoly-ish.
Yes.
So we've got five things about this deal that are a little weird. Number one.
Five things I hate about Warren Anderson.
So this conservatory that he sold for $19 million, he bought 2 weeks previously for $9 million.
Damn.
What?
Yeah. Julius wasn't meant to be able to sign the deal. He signed the deal while he was acting finance minister while the finance minister was away.
Holy shit.
The thing about the conservatory is that Warren had paid $9 million for it in theory, but he actually didn't even own the conservatory when he made the sale to Julius Chan. He was like, I'll buy it for $9 million if I can get the Papuans to pay $18 million for it. And the owner is like, sure, I don't give a fuck. Then, while all of this is happening, it's found out that Warren is negotiating building an office in Port Moresby on land that Julius Chan owned.
Right, so this is just like a I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine kind of thing.
Yes.
It's like, hey, I will double the cost of this stupid fucking building and make you pay for it, and I get to build on your land.
It's like a you scratch my back, and I scratch my back as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, what does Julius want with an observatory?
a conservatory?
Casey, you're so funny. It's just an office building. It's a conservatory.
Damn.
Not an observatory.
I swear it's a said observatory.
I may well have.
I just thought that was so super villain for a second.
It's like, just offices.
What are they looking for up there? What's in the stars?
They're looking for Papua Old Guinea.
Fuck.
That's it. If I set up a laser telescope.
Yeah, they're setting a laser up in Cairns. No,
anything happens in Cairns.
It's an office building. They can't get anyone to move into it in the end as well. Like, they, I think, end up selling it for a loss or whatever. Or they still own it, but, like, it's only partially occupied. Like, it's just a whole mess. $1 million of extras that were added onto the purchase remain a mystery.
Ooh.
What do you mean?
Prostitutes.
Yeah, no one knows. Warren Anderson's Wikipedia page is mostly investment controversies. That was a big section, including something called the Rothwell's Loan. Like, it's called the Rothwell's Loan, but loan's in quotes. So it's like the Rothwell's Loan. So I don't know if it's like not a real loan.
So it's stolen then or something.
Yeah, I think he just stole some cash or something. I didn't really read about it. And he's a classic old like British style plantation billionaire type. He's been bankrupted a few times. He had 2,000 exotic Asian and African animals on a cattle station in the Northern Territory for a while that he had to sell. And he's currently arguing with his ex-wife about the sale of some fine art, antiques, and about 300 guns that he earned. Because he claims to be broke now, so they're selling off his assets so he can pay his ex-wife or whatever. Anyway, about 2 months ago, Prime Minister James Marape announced that his business partner Julius Chan was going to be on the 100 Kina banknote. So, you know, crime pays if some businessman will pay you to crime for him.
Jesus.
And he did it so well.
Talking about pieces of shit, let's get to BHP, the world's largest
big
mining company.
Big happy place.
Yeah.
Big happy place. Actually, yeah, what's BHP stand for?
Yeah, big happy place.
Yeah, yeah, obviously.
Something petroleum.
No.
Beautiful heaven paradise.
No.
Big hefty penis.
That's it.
I knew it. I knew it.
So, big hefty penis, the world's largest mining company, currently CEO'd by the slimy-looking Mike Henry pictured on your screen here. He wasn't CEO at the time of what we're going to talk about, but I figured it would be prudent for us to know about the boy prince in his face. Mike's like 60, to be clear, but BHP behaves more like an empire than even I realized. Here is a headline from 2023.
BHP CEO Mike Henry's new relationship approved by board.
So there's been a marriage arranged between the CEO of BHP and the CEO of this Canadian railway company.
What?
That are working together. And
you can't be doing, like, hey, let's all pause. We cannot be doing that shit.
Why?
I don't like it.
You don't like arranged marriages?
Okay, Pauline Hans.
I don't like it. Well, it just feels like we're going to, like, just everybody's going to be like, oh, yeah, cool. So now we just have new royalty in ways that are just so much more on the nose than before.
It's just we do. It's Mike Henry and this lady from the Canadian Railway Company or whatever.
You know, was the dowry or whatever?
It's Broken Hill Proprietary.
Oh, you were looking it up?
Yeah, that's
what I was
doing. I was
about to reveal it to you.
No!
It's my next sentence.
No!
So BHP, which stands for Broken Hill Proprietary, but
I
guess...
Is it really Broken Hill?
It is.
Yes.
Holy shit.
It started there?
I think... It starts with a land claim in Broken Hill. I don't know if the company itself was necessarily.
Are you personally familiar with Broken Hill?
Well, it's small and it's out there and it just doesn't sound like the place that.
It's notable for being out in the middle of nowhere.
And I wouldn't name like a big company from that. So from them to start small out there.
Yeah,
I think my aunt used to live out there before she died, but
damn,
it's kind of small.
BHP is also known as the Big Australian, not like the Big Australian company. No, just the Big Australian.
The Big Australian.
Just the Big Australian.
Wanker.
The Big Australian penis. Big hefty penis. In the 1980s and 1990s, they are running a mine in Papua New Guinea called the Ok Teddy Mine. That's the Ok Teddy Mine.
Okay, Teddy.
Okay, Teddy.
It is spelled okay, Teddy. This is mostly owned by BHP at the time, with the government of Papua New Guinea owning like a third of it and a Canadian mining company owning the rest. I don't know if it's Mike Henry's like wife's company. But this is like Mike Henry's like 20 at this point. He's not here. So at Ok Teddy, you can mine copper and gold, and the sales from it are something like, at the time, a sixth of PNG's export revenue.
Oh,
especially after the mine in Bougainville's closed.
Mm.
Right, so this is that time. It's known as the Ok Teddy mine because it's on the Ok Teddy River, which is a fun one, because from what I understand, Ok is a local word for river. Teddy is the name for that river. So I guess locally it just means the river.
Mm.
So Ok is kind of like a language family word for
yeah.
a river, but Teddy is what like people who live next to it call the river. They call it Teddy.
Yeah.
And so when it's called Ok Teddy River,
I think it's river. Nice.
And yeah, that's in Yongom is the language / family that is being referred to here.
Dwayne the Rock Johnson. River
Phoenix.
It sounds like somebody like old school like DJing.
River the River. Yeah, Dwayne the Ok Teddy.
Damn.
Anyway, so like tens of thousands of people depend on it for water. It's a river. So BHP is getting pretty rich off this copper mine, but the Papuan government is ensuring they stick to environmental best practice and looking after all the vulnerable people that rely on the river.
I'm sure.
Before mining can start, BHP is required to make a dam that catches all the toxic shit created by like ripping coins and telephone wire out of the ground or whatever it is when you're mining copper, and allowing it to be the toxic stuff to be transported somewhere else. This is known as a tailings dam, and the mine runoff is known as tailings.
Where are they going to take it?
Doesn't matter. The dam was destroyed in a landslide before the mine opened, and in response, BHP just started shitting over the fence like Clive, dumping 90 million tons of tailings into the river every year for 10 years. And it seems like they kind of told the government, you're going to have to just amend the laws because we're not doing a dam.
They let it go what for 10 fuck? Years.
Oh, no, it's still going, I think. But yeah, like, there's 10 years that BHP is just doing it, being like, you're just going to have to change the law because, like, we're not building another dam.
And we want to mine,
right? You don't have any other money coming in, right? Unless you can get Bougainville fixed, you better send some helicopters in there because otherwise we're going to fucking poison all this river because we ain't building a dam. Anyway, so the tailings are like rocks and sand and sludge and water, and then it's just like literally cyanide for a while.
Jesus Christ.
Alkalines and nutrient stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is just a slurry of death. It kills a bunch of like fish and like food, bananas and taro and trees and a lot of people as well. So enter Rex Doggy. Karen, you want to explain the picture we have here of Rex Doggy, who's the gentleman on the left?
Okay. It's a shame he's the one on the left because the one on the right is like really hot.
He looks hotter now, the one on the right.
Do you think?
Yeah, I don't have a picture of him now.
Devastating.
But I was looking everyone up, and he's still a lawyer.
Hell yeah.
And he looks, like, incredible. Not Silver Fox, because he's bald.
Nice.
But, like
Shiny Fox.
Shiny Fox.
Yeah. Very handsome older man.
Hell
very
yes.
handsome older man.
Well, but look, yes. He had all the foundation ready to go. All right. Rex. Rex is a gentleman. He's got a nice thick moustache. He's got a big smile and he's holding aloft above his head some paperwork, it appears. And then he's got like a hot young thing on the side. You know how it is.
He's gorgeous. That man is gorgeous.
He's actually, I'm looking at him and I'm like, that's not possible.
I should have written his name down. I'm sorry I didn't.
Hot nameless guy.
He works he works for Slater Gordon. He's a lawyer.
Okay.
So Rex is described as one of the first Yongon villagers to gain a formal education. So he's like a legal activist of some sort. And I think that paints enough of a picture of the power imbalance here. So Rex has been trying to take legal action on behalf of the affected Yongon people. And, you know, doing that alone in the Papua New Guinean courts is completely useless.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, what are you talking about? In a series of inspirational events, though, Rex gets some help from the crew at Slater and Gordon, the Australian law firm. Heavily associated with the Labour Party, I think. And he gets 30,000 villagers to sign on as plaintiffs against BHP.
Yes.
And in the picture on screen, he is triumphantly holding up the lawsuit on the steps of the Supreme Court of Melbourne.
Oh.
Yeah. So basically, they were like, well, what if we sue them in Melbourne? Then
that's a workaround.
The government will not have less power than the company they're trying to...
Yeah.
Like... work with, right? Like,
yeah.
The Papua New Guinean government is less important than BHP.
Mm.
So, Rex Doggy has to stay in Melbourne for a while because the government drafts a law making it illegal for any Papuan citizen to pursue legal action in another country.
What?
Which isn't that so convenient.
Well, it's discovered that the drafts for this law were not written by Julius Chan, but by BHP's lawyers.
Yeah, no shit. No shit. Given that we're already like, yeah, change the law for us. We're not building that goddamn dam.
Yeah.
Of course, they're going to be like, yeah, actually change the law again. Nobody's allowed to sue us.
Yeah. So the Slater and Gordon lawyers are like, wait a second. This is like early internet times. And they're like, word processors all have distinct codes on them. Mm. So they found the draft documents which were leaked. And they're like, wait a second. This code aligns to the BHP offices in Victoria or whatever.
Fuck.
Then it's leaked that BHP was offering, like, elders and such, trying to comprador, being like, we'll give you $200 if you drop it, if you get your whole village to drop it. We'll get you $200. Apparently the quote is like, we'll solve the problem the Melanesian way.
Are you kidding?
What?
I'm not kidding. Might be apocryphal, but I'm not lying.
That's
and then they just threaten some people. So BHP ends up like actually eating shit on the stock market.
Good.
Right? So they have to react as a company. And they settle out of court. Of Slater and Gordon. This is 1996. Did they build a dam in the end is your question? No. They said it would be too expensive.
Oh, God.
So they've done some dredging. And that should actually clear up the tailings in like 300 years.
Fuck.
BHP also got legal immunity from future lawsuits. When they did the deal with the government. And when the government starts taking shares back, BHP still gets to have like 3 board positions. So they've what always the got control.
Yeah.
And they do have to do a public apology. And it's very like, you know, we weren't the BHP we wanted to be.
Jesus Christ.
Karen, I've got a picture that'll come up of the then BHP CEO, Paul Anderson, and his apology.
All right. So from the, God, look at him. Hello.
Rat looking motherfucker.
Peter Pettigrew boy.
He does look Peter Pettigrew.
Yeah. Are these bottom teeth or his top teeth?
Both.
Yes.
Oh, they're just teeth.
Yeah. So those ones on the side are like his top teeth, and those ones are his bottom teeth, and they just kind of grow over
each other. Yeah.
No, I'm imagining that like his bottom and top teeth are
connected.
Like, what the fuck is going on?
Exactly. He's just like that the whole time. Fucking bitch ass motherfucker. Anyway, this is Paul Anderson.
Okay. The Ok-Tedi mine was not compatible with our environmental values.
We are deeply sorry.
And the company,
we're sorry.
Should never have been involved.
We're sorry.
It's yeah. Okay, Teddy. It's no okay, Teddy.
I just want to say sorry to the fans. I've really let you down.
Sorry.
Oh my God, I said I wouldn't cry.
We're sorry.
Like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe. Please support me. Every day, I'm just trying to be the best person I can be. I'm really just trying to learn.
I'm trying to be the biggest, happiest.
I'm just human. We all make mistakes. I didn't know that it would poison all the water.
Sorry.
And even if I did, like, I'm just a girl. What am I supposed to do?
I feel as broken as the hill we were built upon.
Oh. So, when the PNG government fully nationalized the Ok-Tedi mine in 2013, they also got rid of BHP's immunity, but I don't think there's been another lawsuit or anything. BHP's like, no, we have, like, insurance for all of that. There can't be a lawsuit.
Oh, I hope if they got rid of their immunity, I hope to God somebody hits them with, like, a crazy amount. Like, they're just getting their medical shit all ready for all the people who are affected.
I would hope so. I'd be very surprised based on
the history.
based on what happened. We're going to come back to Ok-Tedi one day. I have a few people I've been put in contact with that were working around like the Ok-Tedi process that I'm hoping to speak to. We'll do some interviews. I'm thinking of messaging Rex Doggy, who is still active on Facebook.
Sure.
In like, you know, talks about like still active in I guess politics in the region.
Hell yeah. Fly, interview Northern Rex. Fly.
I really want to talk to Rex. He's got like sick dreadlocks now.
You gotta snag him.
I gotta snag him. But I don't know how to do that. But yes, anyway, I was also gonna talk about Manus Island today, but it's dawning on me how much bigger and more important that story is than this last little chunk of the episode we've got today. So it's about time we get to what was meant to be the subject of the episode, my second least favorite Ukrainian-Australian, and certainly the worst ever Ukrainian-Australian pop one, Justin Kachenko.
Yes, let's go. Oh, God.
Doesn't he give you Jabba the Hutt vibes?
Yeah, he looks like the crazy frog made human.
Wow. That's a wild pull.
How dare you change my perception of reality?
Yeah.
What the fuck? That's wild. All right, yeah. So this crazy frog ass motherfucker, Justin Kachenko. So with all that we've said about the roles, and by we, I mean me, the roles of different the roles of different turncoats, the race trader, the intermediary, the comprador, they are all subservient to the expat. The expat's usually an unhealthy-looking, sunburned, bethroned white man who drops a few coins on the ground for the natives to scramble over and pick up. Here's Justin at a recent ceremony in Moresby South, recognizing people's efforts in community development.
Oh, Lord above.
God.
It's like they've just here? Kind of, like, poured him into that chair. The man fills it. Like, he's not even, like, he's not standing up to award these people. When there is, like, genuinely a man with a walking stick standing.
Yeah,
to
literally.
And this guy is sitting on a very fancy chair. Oh, my God, I just saw the guy who's behind him in the first photo.
It's insane.
Oh, God, he looks like he's so shocked. God, even in the second one, he's like, nah, I'm not meant to be here. I don't want to be here.
He just can't keep it. He can't keep it in. He tried to, but he's just like, no.
He's realizing what his country is.
Yeah, in he's
this
like, exact
this is the face of trauma. You like know, a, he's like just a like, deep, irreparable trauma.
This is like, Justin Kachenko.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's looking and he's like, hey, this man receiving whatever the fuck this is from, like, yeah, this Jabba the Hutt motherfucker is like an old grandpa. You know, he looks like a sweet old man. And then you turn and you see this, like, blinding pale monstrosity.
Yeah.
And I imagine he's just like, fuck, this is awful.
This looks like a real life reimagining or interpretation of like a caricature, you know, the caricature of the capitalist. You know how they draw them. You know how they draw them. It looks exactly like
it
that.
Does. Yeah. It does.
Like you put one of them into AI. Yeah. Make it real. Sorry.
Yeah. I was going to say, it looks like he's poured hot white wax. Yes. Like the way that he rolls down. It's like
he does really just roll down.
He looks like the idea of Denethor eating tomatoes from Lord of the Rings. If anybody catches that reference, I'll kiss you like open mouth with tongue.
You'll do that to me anyway, but you know I don't understand what that means.
It's fine, don't worry about
Nobody
it.
Nobody understood that.
So you say Denethor?
Yes, Denethor.
No, you fucking nerd. We're broken this up.
Fuck off!
What is Denethor?
Just Denethor eating tomatoes. Just look it up.
Is it The Hobbit or is it one of the...
It's Lord of the Rings!
I don't remember
He's
tomatoes.
The steward of Gondor. He's eating tomatoes and fucking Merry sings the little song where he's just like, come Master Hobbit. Sing me a song. And he's like, I have no songs fit for your great halls. And he's just like, you must know something.
And then I must have blocked it out because I do not remember tomatoes.
Neither.
Was it director's
cut? Why are
there
tomatoes in that part of the Five Kings?
Why is he eating tomatoes?
Yeah, I remember the old man, the creepy one that goes nuts.
Oh, that's
Denethor.
I don't remember the name.
I didn't know his name.
That's Boromir and Faramir's dad.
I haven't watched it in like 15 years.
I'm going to rip all of my toenails out.
You can do that anyway. It's not going to affect me.
Well, I guess so. I hope you know that you feel bad about it. Yeah. Fuck.
I'm sorry, baby.
Editor, cut this. It doesn't matter. Turns out I'm too much of a dork.
You're not too much of a dork. You're just the dorkiest one here.
Thanks.
Someone has to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, nerd.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Anyway, so this Justin Denethor Kachenko.
Thank you.
There's a fairly robust Facebook news ecosystem in Port Moresby, English language and Tokpisin, in which there's a pretty good Google Translate for. So I had some fun collecting some sledges about our boy Justin. I thought I'd show you some of the funny ones, if only to establish how little many people on the ground take him seriously. Who wants to read this first one?
I'll do it. Obesity and overweight. This guy is surviving with people's money by just staying alive. Unfit and lazy. People, this guy can't perform anymore. Why are we still keeping this clown? Time to remove and replace.
So obviously I've only got ones in English and like most of them are obviously in Tokpisin. I didn't want to do the translation. Who wants to read the second one?
Yeah, sure. There is nothing wrong with these comments. JT faced on the billboard for what? What has he done for this nation? Is JT a father of this nation? He's a fucking foreigner. A white bastard.
White bastard as Jessica.
White bastard.
Take it down. That billboard of Justin Kachenko is an insult to our nation. He is not a founding father, played no role in independence, and has no right to be the face of our 50th anniversary.
So this billboard that they're talking about, I've just realized I haven't got it on the slide, but I'll pass it around for you. Here's a picture of it. So again, Papua New Guinea's 50th anniversary. Justin Kachenko's dad's in Ukraine 50 years ago. He's not even in Australia at that point, I reckon. But there's these big billboards up in Papua New Guinea with his face on him, being like, 50 years of independence, celebrating Justin Kachenko. What the fuck?
I'm glad you're having the same reaction as me.
Why? What does this mean?
He's just kind of the king there.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's painted very much like it feels like I don't know, like a 50s propaganda style. Yeah. Where it's that kind of like...
It looks like a picture of Stalin.
Yeah.
Exactly. I was like, this looks like fucking World War II propaganda. Yeah. Like it looks like... It looks like the kind of shit you would see on like Victory Day.
Yeah.
Or something.
So, Justin has a guy arrested for making fun of the billboard.
Hell yeah. I mean,
oh, wow.
Bad.
I mean, hell no.
That is so lame.
That is so uncool.
I don't think I have the picture. I wish I had the picture. So he has this picture. There's this picture of this guy took of the guy who's been arrested, and he's just kind of like standing in a cell in the open. He just looks real confused. And like, I wish I saved it. But it's a real funny picture. But finally, we have this. This is somebody in Moresby South's view on Justin having people arrested. What?
I was just scratching that, and I can really hear it. I thought it was you, and then I was like,
which one of you
making the fucking noise?
It's me.
You're just looking like this.
If someone would like to read this one out, it's a rant.
Whoever say poor person is not a right statement. We are not living in a poorest country, and we are not primitive animal living in primitive world. PNG is a country where are abundantly blessed with many resources. All citizens of PNG must know that all the foreigns coming into our country, they don't love us, but they love our resources like gold, gas, oil, ant, etc. That one took me off guard, I'm not going to lie. So they're going to use you like a primitive animal to build their wealth and their empire. This is a democratic society. Every citizen have a right to speak. You don't have a right to arrest the citizens of this country. There is Human Rights Act protect every citizen's right to speak. This is very disgraceful to see this. Is a leader of its own right. Go and arrest those corrupted leader in the parliament who still funds. A leader who speak his country. Thanks, UPNG. Happy Independence Day, 50th anniversary.
I love, thanks, PNG. Happy Independence Day. Yeah, I love this rant.
How do you keep it together?
It's not the silliest
thing.
Well,
that's the problem. I really couldn't do it at gold, gas, oil, ant.
I think that's just the time.
It's the only ant mine in the world.
It's the only
ant. So rare. You know?
I want to be cool. I want to be clear. I like this person. I like their ant. However, it's very funny that they've said ant. I think it's meant to be ant.
It's supposed to be ant.
I imagine it is.
Oil, ant, etc.
It is. It's like gold, gas, oil, ant. So, this fucking guy, Justin Kachenko, right? Everyone fucking hates this guy. He's arresting people in the streets and shit.
Yeah.
What's going on here? Well, I don't really know. I don't really know much else than what we knew last time. He was born in 1972 in Melbourne to Ukrainian immigrants, like we talked about when we chatted about him before. Elle, you were saying how Justin Kachenko is a really weird name.
A weird combination of names.
Yeah,
it's very odd to have that first name with that surname. It just sounds so off. And I don't know, I feel like Justin is a very modern name.
Yes. And Kachenko is a very...
Well, that's not really... I mean, like, he just looks too old to be called
ancient.
Justin.
That's very true. 70s, you don't know many, like, 50-year-old Justins. So, he doesn't finish high school. He goes to TAFE. He gets a landscaping degree. And then he somehow finds his way to Port Moresby in his early 20s. When he's 22 years old, Bill Skate appoints him curator of the National Capital District Botanical Gardens. Or the NCD, Botanical Gardens. We'll call it the NCD when we refer to it later. Bill Skate is a hard motherfucker with a white father who is going to end up Prime Minister of PNG after the Sandline Affair kills the Julius Chan government. Somebody, I have to imagine somebody in Papua New Guinea, made this Pokemon card of Bill Skate a few years after he died from a stroke.
Bill Skate, level X. The card is called Stroke 200. Flip a coin of heads, it kills the opponent if it takes you.
If tails
oh,
kills
if
you.
Tails. Damn, heart problems. It slowly kills you and make you take no damage.
Yeah, so that's the
what
Bill Skate.
What the fuck? That's
Pokemon
actually
card.
Really funny.
I don't know what the deal is with that, but he had a stroke and died, so I guess that's the joke there. But when Bill gets elected, he installs Justin as deputy administrator of the NCD, which is a pretty serious position for a 25-year-old Australian gardener. Though this is the year Justin won a British Empire Medal for services to the orchid industry.
Fuck off.
Okay, that one's respectful. I can respect that.
We like orchids. Do you reckon Justin Kachenko is really about orchids like that?
I'm hoping he has one saving grace, and he does.
Maybe that's
after
it.
After he does all of those terrible things, he goes back to his greenhouse, and he like loves these orchids. It's the only thing he has, like, his heart beats for.
His
and then
big
he does
heart.
All of that other shit out there.
Maybe it's all for the orchids.
Yeah, it's like,
all the money
yeah.
for the orchids.
Yeah, it's like Dr. Freeze with his wife, right? Like you
it
love
is like
his
Dr.
story,
his
but
wife.
He's absolutely evil.
You've lost biggest dork.
Don't worry, I understood that one. So
damn it! I don't know Dr. Freeze's wife. I don't know Dr. Freeze.
I don't know who this man is.
Yeah, who's this man?
Batman. Supervillain?
Oh, yes, no. The Freezy Man.
He's done by Arnold Schwarzenegger in the movie.
He's done by Arnold Schwarzenegger in the movie. I do know that. That's all I know about him. And his wife.
Maybe we should watch the Batman movies as well.
That doesn't seem...
It's so camp. Uma Thurman is Poison Ivy. Oh.
I don't need to watch movies to experience camp. So, Bill, Bill seems to have largely got elected on the back of bribery by his advisor, a guy named Mujo Seifa. Mujo, after falling out with Bill in what I assume is a power struggle, makes a secret tape in which Bill is heard saying, among other things.
We cut the man to pieces. If I tell my gang members to kill, then they kill. There is no other godfather. I am the godfather.
That's Prime Minister.
On the day of my daughter's wedding?
You come to me.
On the day we're going to cut my daughter's canoe from my canoe. Yeah, that's the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea at the time, Bill Skate.
Oh, look how they massacred my boy.
Yeah. That's not just a picture of him I found.
Controversy. His arteries massacred him.
So this doesn't kill him, his Prime Ministership. Controversy continues following Bill's tenure, and he only lasts until 1999. Which is probably the only reason Justin doesn't immediately become vice principal or whatever it is he was going to be. Well, there's sort of two other reasons. The same year, Justin is charged with carnal knowledge against the order of nature, so like rape, which is, I think, settled out of court.
What the fuck is that terminology?
He's also charged for sodomy. But like, I think, did you and I talk about this? No, I spoke about it with someone else. We figured out, like, at first it was like, oh, sodomy. Is this like he's been arrested for having gay sex? But it seems like he assaulted a woman and also like sodomized her, which is great because we're talking about like the 90s.
Yeah.
I didn't think they were still using that term. Anyway, the same year, he's found guilty of misappropriating money raised for the NCDC 3 times. Like misappropriating money is almost overstating what he did. Someone's paying the NCD, the Capital Development Authority. They write a check out to him, and he's like, thank you. And then he deposits the check in his bank account. And he does this for like 4,000, and then 8,000, and then like 12,000 kina. It gets bigger each time. Bill Skate also gave Justin's landscaping company a big old contract for the Prime Minister's residence.
Naturally.
Without a tender process, you know, no bids or whatever. Anyway, Justin's first tilt at formal politics is a failure, as he comes up against the behemoth of Dame Carol Keeter.
Wow, Dame Carol.
That's Dame Carol Keeter.
Librarian coded.
Yeah. She makes a mean quiche. You can tell.
She's married to the, like, chief of law or whatever in Papua New Guinea. I forgot the name. Attorney General or something. He's knighted, and so that's why she's a dame.
Can I also just say Dame Carol?
Dame Carol. They're
Dame
calling me
Carol.
Dame Carol's crazy. So, Justin, in 2006, is granted citizenship of Papua New Guinea despite just, like, committing crimes for the whole time he's been there. And though he takes a bite out of Dame Carol's votes, he's not able to unseat the beloved figure of Dame Carol. Although he's unsuccessful, his friend Powers Parkop becomes governor of Port Moresby or something like that, and he gives Justin a 10 million kina contract to beautify Port Moresby, one of his biggest windfalls so far. Mm-hmm. Powers does this all the time. Eventually, he's going to give a random Malaysian woman 3 million kina to run public yoga classes. And everyone, like, there's talk that she's, like, his secret girlfriend, although she denies it. She's like, when people here see a man and a woman walking around together, even if they're doing business, they think they're in a relationship, which does feel
very familiar. That'd be happening.
It is a big amount of money being paid to a younger, attractive woman by a politician, which does have a certain shape of it as well. So, you know, I kind of believe all of it. Like, either way, it's shady. Anyway, back to Justin, who's never fucking done yoga, I have to guarantee. When Dame Carol retires before the 2012 election, he runs with Powers' Social Democratic Party, and he steamrolls a bunch of independents. When the parties that win the election form a ruling coalition, he switches over to the winning People's National Congress and becomes Minister for Sport under Prime Minister Peter O'Neill.
Peter Schmader.
Like Bill Skate, Peter O'Neill's father was a white man, a Kiop specifically.
Oh, shit.
So there's probably something there about the power of mixed-race people in Papua New Guinea, but it is an hour and a half in. So, in 2013, there's a new Papua New Guinea Rugby League team. Rugby League team announced called the Kumuls, actually. And they are completely in personal control of Sports Minister Justin Kachankar.
Of course.
His daughter, that same year, described as Brisbane-based Savannah Kachankar, beats a bunch of Papua New Guinean youth swimming records.
I'm glad you, like, didn't stop at youth.
Youth.
She just goes up and beats a bunch of youth.
She beats a bunch of youth. Out of these kids.
You talking about youth crime? I'm going to crime youth. Isn't that so? She, like...
Crime against youth.
Crime against youth manity. So she lives...
I love that card game.
Savannah lives and trains in Brisbane, and Justin keeps buying houses with money that he's getting from Papua New Guinea there. But whatever. And then she goes to Papua New Guinea to win, like, local tournaments against, I have to assume, mainly kids without access to, like, Olympic pools and shit. And she's like, I'm the best swimmer in Papua New Guinea, Dad. Look, we met Savannah in our last episode about this motherfucker. The timeline I have drops off until 2018, though, when a Justin Kachenko impersonator is arrested.
What?
I don't know. I think he's protesting Justin's involvement in organizing the 2018 APEC summit. Mm. So APEC, we heard about it in Australia when the chaser dressed up as Osama bin Laden and snuck into George Bush's motorcade. Do you remember this?
No.
They got very through funny. So many they, levels of security.
I bet it was funny.
It was one of the funniest. So basically, there was an Australian comedy group called The Chaser, and they had a fake motorcade car with like Canadian flags and fake security guards. And George Bush was coming for APEC in Sydney, I think. And they get past all these levels of security with their fake shit. And eventually, they're like further than they thought they'd get. So they're like, we have to pull the plug. So the guy gets out of the car, and he's dressed as Osama bin Laden.
Hell yeah. Let's fucking go.
And it's like, we just didn't think we'd get this far. We thought I was going to have to get out there. Like, we have to pull the plug. Like, we're actually getting close enough where we might get shot.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Anyway.
We can't let that happen.
We can't shoot Chaz Lichardello. Anyway, APEC is a free trade organization focused on the Asia-Pacific. As we move from colonialism to neocolonialism, these bureaucratic-style organizations pop up over whatever grouping you want. Whenever you see a group being described as being in favor of free trade, it's a euphemism for laws and policies that give businesses massive leeway for massive profit. Right? Businesses can freely operate without, you know, clumsy taxes or whatever, making it hard for them to operate in the way that the market decides they should. There are 21 member countries in APEC, and the representative is usually, like we talked about, George Bush. It's the leader. So some important people are going to be coming down to Papua New Guinea, and Justin wants to make a good impression. So, you know, for reference, here's the 21 current political leaders of the APEC countries. They all look like photos of a prime minister. I mean, there's some weird names here, like Vladimir Putin looks a bit more serious. Bongbong Marcos looks, you know, stupid, like usual.
Anwar Ibrahim's having a bad day.
Anwar Ibrahim doesn't look very happy at all. John Lee is the chief executive of Hong Kong, which is a crazy title for the head of a country. And then Donald Trump's photo looks evil. It's just kind of weird. So Julius is having a great time setting this up. His landscaping company is providing all the plants for the Hilton Hotel that's being built for the summit. So he's making a bunch of money off it as well. And then they spend $6.5 million on 40 luxury Maserati sports cars for the world leaders to drive them around while they're here, right? So they go to these Maseratis, right? And they're like, we imported these straight from Italy. Xi Jinping and Jacinda Ardern, like, bring their own cars. Like, they're like, I'm not driving around in a Maserati that's been bought for me. That will look like terrible back home.
Yeah.
Justin's office puts out a statement about it. It has the wrong date. It's like a month in the future. And they claim that the Maseratis were like a gift from a private benefactor. It hasn't cost the government anything. PNGI Central, a news source, investigated this and found that the $1 million in freight to transport the Maseratis was definitely paid by the Papuan government, right? So then Justin has to come out and talk about that. And he's like, all right. No, we might have paid some, like, a deposit. But we're going to sell the Maseratis and make back all the money. Which is apparently illegal based on what he said, because apparently they don't own them, because they didn't buy them.
Yeah.
And then he admitted to the ABC that the government had paid the deposit. And then he told the ABC the government had just paid for them completely. And then an invoice came out and it showed that the cars were bought via a backyard workshop in Sri Lanka. All of this was controversial domestically, as Papua New Guinea was going through a tuberculosis and polio outbreak concurrently.
What the fuck?
But Justin's performance was so special and amazing, he was awarded a Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire for successfully pulling off APEC 2018.
And what year was this?
2018.
What the fuck?
Yep.
That's fucked.
I hate this.
Yeah. When only two of the Maseratis had been sold a year later, the People's National Congress Party loses favor, and the Social Democratic Party is back in action, baby. After Justin had left POWs in the Social Democratic Party a decade earlier, it's just so fitting that the SDP, gaining power again, knocks Justin Kachenko out of government.
Good.
Oh, wait, no, he has to be in government for some reason. So POWs is like, Justin left the SDP to facilitate these great events like APEC, and now he's back where he belongs. And he just lets him join again and makes him foreign minister.
What the fuck?
You know, because he speaks Australian or whatever. Here's a picture of the Papua New Guinean government, I guess. You'll notice two things. One is this guy is too tall to be in the front row.
Yes.
And two, Justin Kachenko doesn't know how to stand.
No, what the fuck? He's not even looking in the right direction.
His head is tilted.
He's doing a blue steel.
Yeah, he is.
He's wearing like
popping a shoulder out a little bit.
Yeah, everyone else
look
is
dainty.
Standing face
look dainty, a little bit sexual.
He's white. I mean, there's this guy who looks like mixed or whatever. But yeah. In 2022, people realize he's buying and selling property in Brisbane, which is meant to be illegal for him in his position, but it doesn't matter. Justin announces that Papua New Guinea is planning on negotiating a security treaty with Australia, saying he's been discussing it with Penny Wong. He says, it will make us connected in all aspects of anything that might arise now or into the future. This was announced alongside the $175 million package the Australian government announced to upgrade the Lombrum naval base on Manus Island. Justin sues a guy named Robert Agan for defamation because Robert had accused him of land grabbing on Facebook, so using his governmental powers to possess land. The magistrate ruled that Robert has enough proof to back up the claim, so he can say whatever, as Robert has proof that the land was transferred from the NCD to Justin's wife. In May, this is a few months before the whole thing with his daughter, where she's going on the... We spoke about this before, but briefly, they flew to King Charles's coronation. She goes with him. They're doing it on the Papua New Guinean government money. They stay at fancy hotels. She makes a bunch of luxury TikToks. When people accuses him of wasting the government's money, he calls them primitive animals. The works. He resigns for like 6 months, but he's back in time to call his shot on the eve of our last election. Papua New Guinea's foreign minister wants Labour to win the Australian election because he's like, yeah, if Labour win, this military deal is going to be signed. And like, obviously, Labour won and here we are. Papua New Guinea's been drafted into Australia's military. And Justin Kachanko stays winning despite never doing a good damn thing for anyone. Thoughts? That's the episode.
Well, nice job, firstly.
Thanks, yeah.
Secondly, he's just a villain. He's just like a comic book villain. Like,
yeah. It doesn't make sense if you don't understand how much power Australia has over Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, they won't touch him.
Exactly, like, because why else would you let this happen?
I mean, I'm deeply fascinated by, what power does this man have? Like, what is he holding over, like, all of Papua New Guinea? And if it's just the threat of Australia, why...
It's not really, he just pays the right people off, and he has enough money to pay enough people off.
And his orchid mastery.
And the orchid stuff. Listen, the orchid, like, the big question is definitely, like, how did all that shit happen in his 20s?
Yes.
Like, the rest of it, like, once he's established as a wealthy person in Papua New Guinea, it's like, yeah, and then he just continues does, like, to be wealthy. Shit. Does rich people shit. The big question that I couldn't find any clarity on in what I looked at was, like, how does he go from, like, 22-year-old with not really any qualifications to, like, head guard, like... He doesn't seem to come from a notable family here or anything like that.
Is he just like a yes man with good charisma? Like he was able to just worm his way up.
I think it might.
He's not like a nepo baby.
It might be that, and
he slobbed a few knobs.
You know,
he slobbed some knobs. Justin Slobchanko. Yeah. Nah, he's gonna sue me for that. Fuck you, Justin. I don't know if he's slobbing some knobs. I don't know if Bill Skate's like, oh, this guy's going to be useful for me. I don't know if Bill Skate, because his dad's white, is like, oh, I can relate to this guy. He's like my dad. He's white, unlike all these primitive animals around here. Like,
oh,
I don't know what mixed race people think if they're like mixed white and you're living in the colony.
Yeah.
I don't know that feeling. I know a few Anglo-Indians and, you know, they can be all sorts.
I imagine it's probably incredibly complex.
Yeah.
And yeah.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
I think it's really good.
No, it's actually really fun.
It's actually really fun and good.
That's just so much fun. It's kind of crazy to see from last episode to now kind of like this progression of everything that's happening in PNG.
Yeah.
And just not look at it and be like, what the fuck? Like, just the constant harm that Australia does to this nation that is just constantly excused and washed away, and just like the racism, the extortion is just nuts.
Yeah.
Like it is just nuts.
And a big part of it's because of the, you know, comprador class of PNG. Your James Marapes, your Bill Skates that will, you know, do friendly things for Australian politicians. And they have pretty serious, like this guy that was sued or arrested for saying something about Justin Kachanko. It was over like literally a Facebook post. And I'm gonna try.
Did we do the greetings at the beginning?
Oh no, we forgot to say
oh,
hi.
Oh nice.
Oh fuck.
Good right, catch.
We gotta do the greetings.
We got too caught up on the canoe thing.
Should we do them as byes then? Should we just all say bye to each other at
the
end of the episode?
That sounds nice.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We've been Shouldn't Have Come. If you like what we're doing and you would love to support us, You can have a look at our Patreon. That is www.patreon.com/shouldn'tacome. That's shouldntacome. You can also contact us via email. Tell us your thoughts. And that's at shouldn'tacome@gmail.com. And we're on YouTube. And there's slides on YouTube. If you want to see this shit with slides, go there. That is youtube.com/@shouldn'tacome. And Yanni's album demo is still up on Bandcamp, so go ahead and give it a listen at YaniX, that's YANIX.bandcamp.com.
Yay!
Woo! Hell yeah.
Bye, Karen.
Bye, Yanni.
Bye, Elle.
Bye, Yanni.
Bye, Casey.
Bye, Yanni.
Bye, Casey.
Bye, Karen.
Bye, Elle.
Bye, Karen.
Bye, Elle.
Bye, Casey.
Bye, fuckers.
Archie.
Bye, Archie.
Bye, Archie.